This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location in Alma, Michigan with William Palmer, and he's the author of a forthcoming book, String of Blue Lights. Here's Bill.
A space just for you. You go to pick up a pizza at Sam's. As your car approaches, the sign of fingertips kissed in joy. You see no spaces left in front, so you park and walk half a block to discover, again, there is a space just for you, after all. Why does this keep happening? You're still standing against the cold brick wall of the gym, positive no girl will walk across the shiny floor in her white socks and ask you to dance. But she does.
That was the voice of Bill Palmer, and we're on location in Alma College, where he is lighting up the place with his poetry. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The thing that I like about Bill, and the reason that we're here today making a program about his work, is because he tells us that life is not fatal. His work tells us that with every poem, and we're going to today find out why and how he gets there and what he thinks he's doing. Bill, give us another poem.
A String of Blue Lights. The blue lights I hung above the bookshelves don't blink. They simply give, in quiet glows, a kind of grace on the spines of books for many years unopened, like presents I forget are there. I would like to place a string of blue lights around the head of everyone I know, so I might remember how much I am missing.
William Palmer, Dr. Palmer, author of a very popular textbook on writing and a poet in his own right. And I think that what exemplifies Bill's work more than anything, I guess I can talk to you directly, what
Please.
Exemplifies your work is the personal voice. And yesterday in your class, one of your students said to me, well, isn't that just a matter of taste? If you have, maybe I don't want to hear the essence of your personal voice. Maybe I'd rather learn about Latin history in a poem. What would you answer?
The essence of a personal voice is essential. I mean, a piece of art works, I think, because if it has an authentic voice. I'm not sure how my voice has become authentic, but if it has, it's because I've struggled with it. When I was a boy, I stuttered badly, and so it's been a goal for me to have a voice that could speak freely without stuttering. And writing for me was a way to deal with my stuttering. And I realized through school that if I could write well, then maybe I could speak well. And the writing has helped my speaking. It's given me more control. It's helped me find my voice.
Which, of course, is the metaphor for the human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what you're all about. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're here with Bill Palmer. And he's going to give us another poem.
In fourth grade, I had a teacher that helped me deal with stuttering, and it was a pivotal time in my life. This is called A Spool of Faith, a letter to my fourth grade teacher. How did you know it would give me a spool of faith?
Mm-hmm.
You liked my poem about the blue sky. You asked me to recite it in a tape recorder for parents' night. That afternoon after school, you handed me a small mic, and I read the poem. I read it. Each word whole. I read it, each line complete. I read it and did not stutter once. My words sailing into the bullseye of myself. And then I saw your hands unclench themselves from your mouth, your whole face radiant like an open sky.
What was her name?
It was Mrs. Biddick.
Do you think that you could actually write that in the epigraph? You know why? Because
right.
She will live forever.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice idea.
I mean, the fact is that you and I will go, but Miss
yeah.
Biddick will live forever in that poem because
yeah.
she kind of saved your life.
She did, and it was so remarkable because after I had finished the poem, I did see her face, and her hands were clenched as though she was rooting for me so much to do it well, and I did. And it was her expression that meant the most to me.
How art saves us.
It does.
How does it save us, Bill? How does it? I know it does. I'm always searching for how.
It gives us hope. It gives us faith that life can go on and that it will be better.
And is it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're here with William Palmer, known as Bill Palmer, and he's a poet. And he's an author of a very, very fabulous textbook going into its second printing. And that book is actually a teaching guide. It's called Discovering Arguments,
yes.
An Introduction to Critical Thinking and Writing with Readings. That's a little scary, that title. But then you open it up, and it just explodes with lyrics from pop culture, Bob Dylan, I think the Beatles. I think you've used all kinds of things in this book. What did you hope to do with this book, and what's happening?
Well, I think the book is working well. I co-wrote it with a former professor of mine whose name is Dean Memmering. And I took him for composition courses in college. And he was another teacher who helped me find my voice. He himself had struggles. He has a hemophilia. And he was contacted by Prentice Hall to write a textbook, but he had just had a brain hemorrhage, and he didn't know if he could write one, so he invited me to write one with him. And it took us 6 years, but we did it. And I'm grateful to him for giving me this opportunity, because this book carries my voice as well. And everything I do in my composition courses that I've done for 28 years, I've really put into this book. And so even though it's a book about critical thinking and reading and writing, it's also a book about creativity, and it's a book about persuasive appeals. We try to teach students that every time they write, they can appeal to thinking, to emotion, and most importantly, to character. So I find that those ideas of reason, feelings, and character, it's something that students can use whenever they read, in terms of analyzing or appreciating what they read, and in terms of whenever they write. And the same thing applies to poetry, of course. With poems, I'm more interested in the emotional aspect of poems. Poems still have to appeal to reason in some sense. Poems have to hold together. They have to have a coherence, I think, of reason. But poems also have to be credible. The speaker of a poem has to use details in such a way that make a poem credible and trustworthy. And so all these ideas that I teach in the composition course apply to poetry as well. And I keep discovering that.
I want to say the name of this book one more time because I've traveled the country, I've been around the block, and I've seen a lot of things happen in the classroom, and I believe this book should be in every classroom, and it's called Discovering Arguments, An Introduction to Critical Thinking and Writing with Readings by Dean Memmering and William Palmer, Prentice Hall, now going into its second edition, and hard-earned, well-deserved. I saw you when you started it. You have a little gray around your beard now since you finished it, and it's out there. It's something that didn't exist that exists now is kind of a sacred thing, right?
Well, it feels very important to me. I'm happy about it.
That's Bill Palmer. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and here's a poem.
This is another poem about that fourth grade teacher. And sometimes things happened in school that caught my attention more than what we were supposed to be learning. The char of sugar cubes. His hair was pale, almost gray. Sometimes he fell out of his desk into the space between rows. He landed on the hardwood floor, whimpering, his legs and arms twisting, his frozen eyes holding such want. Then Mrs. Biddick grabbed the jar, her bony fingers unscrewing the lid, and took two cubes like frosted dice and ran, falling beside him and pushing them into his mouth, which he sucked on as if drawing breath. We had never seen such craving met, as if something deeper tasted this rush. Mrs. Biddick now holding him as he murmured, the room soft with light.
Is Mrs. Biddick still alive?
I don't know.
Where was this school?
I'm from Detroit.
Oh, actually, I had forgotten that. I thought you were from the Midwest, but I had forgotten where.
Mm-hmm.
I want to remind our listeners that we're on location in Alma College in a wonderful studio. And we actually have a soundtrack going on. We might hear a piano in the background. We might hear a vocal chord. We might hear a person walking in the hall. And it creates a wonderful soundtrack for our life right now. And we are talking about poetry. And we're talking about there are certain assumptions people make about poetry, but one thing it really does is preserve the beloved. And I like to go in and talk about my fourth grade teacher who saved my soul and from a moment of humiliation. And Miss O'Malley will live forever.
Mm-hmm.
So preserving the beloved is one of the purposes of poetry.
Yes, yes.
And you're doing it.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear more.
Here's another poem from my childhood that it's called Stingrays. We rode that day on our stingrays with long banana seats. We steered high handlebars through unfamiliar streets. We rounded a corner where a small boy played at the side of a house. I looked at him and said, "Nigger." His face fell.
Oh.
I thought my dad would be proud. My friend looked away. I wanted to circle that block again, take back that word, and bury it, like the sparrow I had shot in the birch tree outside my window, with a single copper BB. That small bird fell straight down, and I felt its muffled thump. I ran downstairs and out the door and cupped it in my hands, then walked to our silent backyard.
Well, if the body does not lie, then my body is not lying about that poem. How hard is it to tell the truth?
It's not that hard. It helps me feel better when I tell the truth. I mean, it's hard in certain respects. I'm not sure that I could have written that poem and shared it 25 years ago.
That's what I wondered.
As I've gotten older, I've become more able to tell the truth, to confront really difficult topics, to maybe say that my father was racist and that I thought, in a way, I was doing him a favor by calling this boy that word.
Oh, you know, that is the reason poetry makes life new again.
Yes.
Because of all the racial things that I've read and heard, I've just never heard that. So what poetry does is really rinse off language. I mean, but it took something to overcome, Bill. When I saw you, it was difficult. When you started reading that poem, I saw you overcome something. So it's not that easy to tell the truth.
That's right. That's right. It's a struggle. But I've learned that it's good to try to say the hardest thing. And that's what I try to do in this poem. And that's what I try to do in many poems. And if I'm lucky, then maybe I can stir emotion in readers and help them feel something and help them think about it and help them maybe feel better in some way.
This attitude is paying off for Bill Palmer because I have a list here of 100 or more poems that have been in journals and most recently some in very, very fine periodicals such as the Christian Science Monitor. And he is vastly published. I believe that he was just in the San Antonio Texas Review?
Texas Observer.
Observer, right. So there are people that are responding wholeheartedly to what you're saying. And I think you've turned a corner, Bill. I think you've turned a corner with your art. You don't question it anymore.
Thank you. I think that's true. I'm more comfortable in my art. It's sort of like my voice in that sense. It's just something that doesn't seem foreign to me. I welcome it. I don't have to try really hard to do it. It comes, and I'm open to it.
Let us hear another poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're here with William Palmer at Alma College in Central Michigan with a soundtrack going on in the next room, and we love it.
Thank you. Several months ago, I went to Ghost Ranch, which is a spiritual retreat center in the mountains of New Mexico, and I had a roommate who told me about his wife, and she told me that she knits in the dark.
Yes.
And so when he mentioned that she knits in the dark, I thought, I heard that image, and I thought maybe I can make a poem out of that because it just sounded, it sounded beautiful to me. And so I started a poem, and then during that week, I asked Carl to give me more details so that I could complete the poem, and so he did. And then at the end of the week, I gave it to him, and this is the poem. It's called Knitting in the Dark for Carl Hendrickson. Sometimes when he drives, Carl asks, "Did you see that?" And his wife says, "Yes," though her head is bowed as in prayer. She even knits in the dark, he tells me, a shine in his eyes. She knitted their sons in the dark with no needles or thread, I want to say.
Mm.
One summer, their son Peter worked in a loom shop in Boulder and chose the best pieces of bird's eye maple to make a loom for her. "It works so beautifully," Carl says, shaking his head with wonder. All these years, the fabric of their marriage, the tight weave.
William Palmer, one thing you do for students I saw today was hand out a big green piece of paper. And what does that say?
Well, it says this, "Here is your ticket for noticing things, how sunlight is wide and democratic, how the rain doesn't care who you are, how sounds will follow you home and become songs that play back whenever you want them to." That's from a poem by William Stafford. And so when I begin a creative writing class, I like to give this ticket to students. It's a ticket to ride. It's a ticket to notice things that I hope that they'll do beyond this course. Because Stafford says that if we notice things, it can be a sort of salvation. If we notice small details in the world that are beautiful or that are interesting, and it may be something that's on the visual level, it may be a sound, it may be a comment like Carl said that his wife knits in the dark. I noticed that, and it was enough for me to write a poem. So William Stafford has helped me pay attention to things. Poets, most poets have. Robert Bly has. Grace Cavalieri has. Lucille Clifton has. But William Stafford started it for me.
And if we were to put this in a philosophical overview, I know that you're very much interested in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the one thing the Buddha says: may you be awake one moment before you die.
That's right.
And when I'm with you, I understand what that means. I say it all the time to my students. But when I'm with you, I know what that means, to be awake every minute. But to walk around with your pores open like that, Bill, what can possibly happen? I mean, people need to cover themselves up. That's what the armor's about.
I guess I'm interested in taking off the armor. I don't know how a person can be kind or loving and wear so much armor.
What do you want from your poetry?
I want my poetry to be something like an emotional photograph for people so that they can see what I'm talking about and so that they can feel something inside of it. I'm interested in showing and suggesting. I don't want to tell. I don't want to explain. I somehow want to show through details, through images, figures of speech, just the right words and the right sounds. Show so that people can feel something that maybe they haven't quite felt exactly that way before, but that they have felt, though.
Exactly. And you're just the one who said it. And I would love to hear another poem from this forthcoming book, String of Blue Lights. I'm Grace Cavalieri. That's Bill.
This is something that I felt a week ago. I didn't actually observe this, but it was an intuition that peace was with me. It's called peace. I take it along like a small dog on a leash, though not a leash, really, a braided cord, a thread, or maybe it takes me along. It latches onto me, and I don't feel the click on my invisible collar. It's just there. It jumps on my chair and lies beside me as I read the morning paper. Sometimes it rests its chin on my leg, and I feel its warmth travel through me.
Dr. Palmer has his doctorate in English, and his dissertation was on awareness of writing, very significant, I think. His undergraduate degrees were in teaching English, and his major is English and education, and he has always combined what he learns himself with what he teaches to others, as we're seeing evidence of today. And in my hand, I have lots of credentials here, lots of essays and articles, two dozen more that have been in professional magazines. But through it all, we were talking yesterday about the bird being the artist and the bird watcher being the scholar. It's very hard to be the bird and the bird watcher, but I think that you manage without compromising. I think you are able to put them together in a way that's it's a task.
Mm-hmm.
It's a task.
Yeah.
To remain the bird.
Yeah. I think that there's a spirit about being a writer or a bird that I'm interested in, that I feel at home in. It does help me go places. It helps me fly. It helps me go places on the inside, where that being a scholar doesn't help me go. Being a scholar, reading about poetry or poets or doing any sort of scholarly work, it's important work, but it is more in the head than in the heart. And I'm interested in the exchange between the head and the heart, and that happens more when I write than when I read.
And we are going to be the benefactors now and the beneficiaries of that, so that means you're going to read to us.
This is a poem called Grief. You drive home, a bobber in your throat tugging. You tell your wife you're all right, then squeeze tight the bedroom door. You empty the change from your pocket. The bobber tugging, you lie on your side of the bed, and in the dark there, pull up your grief like a 30-pound muskie. With your teeth, you cut the line. The fish swims through the bedroom air, its dorsal fin gliding across the ceiling, its scales grazing your face. The air is water here. Your wife comes in. The kids can hear you, she says. They're scared. She throws open a window, enough for the grief to slip through. She sits on the side of the bed and holds you, the way your mother did. She tells you dinner is ready. Scales glitter on the dark sill.
The voice of William Palmer. Dinner is ready. There is salvation. There is always another chance. And his poetry teaches us that every step of the way. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back with William Palmer. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location in Alma College. We have a wonderful engineer with us, and we have a sound in the next room of the human voice singing, which is giving testimony to our human voices here.
Yes.
And it's all about breath. It's mm-hmm. all about the essence, and it's all about what it's like to be alive and the inimitableness of what we say, which nobody else can copy.
Yeah.
There is no one else that could have written the poetry that you write. So please continue with another poem.
After I had that experience of grief, I struggled with the idea of forgiveness. And so this poem came out. And it takes a formal form. It's a pontoon. It's called Forgiveness. To forgive is to grow a morning glory in your heart, but the flower stays open all day. Before long, you forget it is there. In your heart, a seed of hope grows in a seed of light. Before long, you forget it is there. Tendrils weave holes through the matted pain. A seed of hope grows in a seed of light, and you begin to see again. Tendrils weave holes through the matted pain. The rope of hate unbraids itself. You begin to see again. To forgive is to grow a morning glory. The rope of hate unbraids itself. The flower stays open all day.
Another wonderful writer, Bob Vivian, quoted a poet who said, "We endure through enduring."
Yes.
And a poem like that is not written at the beginning of the road.
No.
It's written after you trek down that road a little bit. And I was thinking of Frank O'Hara, who had written this fantastic poem about isolation, complete isolation. And then it ends with, "But imagine I am writing this poem in the center of all beauty." So that no matter what we go through when we're writing the poem, in the center of all beauty, redemption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I was surprised because I was thinking about the idea of forgiveness, and then I saw this morning glory, and I'm a big fan of morning glories. I just love the blue color.
I'm a big fan of morning glories.
Yeah, I think they're a very spiritual flower. And so when I noticed a morning glory one day, I thought, well, that was the vehicle that I could use to express forgiveness, because a morning glory is supposed to just stay open part of the day. But if you really forgive people, then that stays open all day.
And I have something like that I'm working on inside of myself, too. So I'll try to use that as a template. But I don't feel like it, Bill. I don't feel like forgiving this person.
Well, that's how I felt as well. In fact, it took me about 10 years to reach this point of being able to forgive certain people. But I feel that I have.
I feel you have, too.
And I'm released by it.
I know. When you think that the guard is as much a prisoner as the prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can't sleep either.
Right.
What are we guarding? That release thing is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
And you say the word spiritual, but you know, you don't have to say the word spiritual. It's like writing about love without using the word love.
Mm-hmm.
Because your poems absolutely are, that's what they're about.
Oh, thank
that's
you.
What they're about. And that's what he's about. And we're going to hear a little bit more from a forthcoming book. We are the first to hear this large a number from a forthcoming book that will be published, String of Blue Lights by William Palmer.
Picking him up at jail, still dark, slivers of ice melting, a few cars running, taillights on, the blow of exhaust. Our son appears with a shadow by the jail light, carrying a bag. He looks for us. His younger brother has fallen asleep, waiting. His mother opens the door and kisses him. I say hi. He looks thinner. At Big Boy's, he eats 2 strawberry waffles and a plate of bacon. He drinks a tall chocolate milk and refills of water. He says he likes water now. At home, he opens Christmas presents we saved for him. A blue Champion sweatshirt, new faded jeans, and white basketball shoes without a mark on them.
Mm. Without a mark on them.
Right.
My one line, which is a sleeper there, where the poem turns, is his younger brother has fallen asleep waiting. That is a very important line to me, and I wonder if it is to you or if it just happened to be an incidental line to you?
That's a great question. It just, to me, it suggests that we had been waiting there so long to pick up our son, and it was early in the morning, like maybe 5 or 6 o'clock, and our youngest son was tired anyway, and even though he was excited to see his brother, He couldn't stay up.
But the literal level is very important. Mm-hmm. And then what happens without us knowing it, if we have a soul, is that what's really being said is that this younger brother's not damaged.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's okay.
That's right.
He's asleep.
Mm-hmm.
He's like at the back of the auditorium when there's a boring lecture. And it's an okay thing.
Sure it is.
And that is a real important line in the mm-hmm. poem, I think.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of wellness going
yes.
on, and nothing ever really dies in your poems. Nothing really dies. You know why?
Why?
Because you don't bury them. You don't bury anything. And Adrienne Rich has something which she says, even if you bury it, it will not die. So why do we bury our secrets? William Palmer, the poet and the poem, we are at Alma College. We are celebrating William today. First of all, the reissuing of his new academic feat, which is Discovering Arguments, an Introduction to Critical Thinking and Writing with Readings by Prentice Hall, which he authored with Dean Memmering. And most of all, though, I came because I needed to be refueled. I needed to have whatever I get when I get in this bubble with someone who is living on the level that Bill is living. And I needed that. And although I taught a class here and talked to students and read a play, this is what I wanted, to hear this. So let me have it.
Thank you, Grace. When I write poems about my oldest son, I am trying to say the hardest thing. It helps me to get it out, to make sense of it, to try to make art with it. And I hope that it helps other parents who are in the same situation. This poem is called Intent to Deliver. You call collect. They put you in a maximum cell, alone 23 hours a day. A few books, though. 2 months out, now back. Your mother nurses her heart in her secret room. It had risen like whole wheat bread we all ate. Today you're on the front page, intent to deliver. Your full name contains my name. It is so clear, our blood. You gave us light when you were too young to know. Your hair grew brown curls like a party, and your smile was wide and free. I'm sorry, we did not intend this. You have delivered so much. Your mother said when she saw you last, you sat in her car and held her hand. You said it was not her fault or mine. You both cried. Then you kissed her.
And then you kissed her.
And then he kissed his mother.
You know, these poems that you're writing, when we say, what does it take to tell the truth, we come up into the whole area of what can we say about our children. You asked me why I didn't write about my child, and I said that one child had been stalked for 7 years and that I did not want that book out, even though it was a strong book. You know, and yet, I think that's a mistake. I think I need to trust that she sees that that's an affirmation and not a denial. And I think you're teaching me that. We have to say to the audience that your son, just for the sake of the record, did not do anything violent. That's very important to
right,
me,
right.
That people have no false assumptions. And it's something, we all go through things with our children that are harrowing. I said to somebody, after you have a child, you'll never be happy in a day of your life. And they thought I was kidding. But of course, it was ironic. But to make art out of it. He will thank you, Bill. Has he read these poems?
He's read some poems, yes.
What does he say?
He doesn't say anything. He receives them. He accepts them. He tells me it's all right if I write poems about him. I think he understands that it's something that's good for me or that I need to do, and he's all right with it.
That is excellent because I think the essential element here is that you asked his permission.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about Sharon Olds, who gets very deep and intimate about her children's lives. and she's very ethical.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it's made it okay with them. And that's the part maybe I haven't done yet with my daughter. I haven't said, look, I have this manuscript about when you were stalked, and what do you feel about it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, until I go there, I can't really do much with a manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
So what you've done is, he's given you the green card William Stafford wrote.
That's right.
Permission to
exactly.
travel.
Exactly, that's nice, yeah. And it's a gift from him. It's a gift from my son to let me do this.
How many prison poems do you have?
Oh, there may be 10 or 15. I'd like to read just one more.
You may read all of them.
Okay. This one is called Visitor's Room at the Correctional Facility. He wants a picture taken of us all. We pay the guard $2.50 and stand before a painting on the cinder block wall near the soda machines. It's a scene of a brown-covered bridge over a slow river, then a forest of light and dark greens, and above it, a thick blue sky. A trusty inmate groups us close. My oldest son stands in the center, his younger brother in a white T-shirt on the right, me on the left, his mom in front. We're all trying to smile. An hour later, the trustee gives us 2 copies. My son looks at home in his skin here, his face calm, his eyes clear. He wears a plaid flannel shirt a guy loaned him, though it's July, instead of his dark blue jumpsuit. My wife looks up, her smile edged with grief. There's a tiny red dot in each of our eyes. Behind us, you can see the tops of trees and the blue sky that looks like a map of open space and what might someday be.
There we go again. There's your son in a white T-shirt.
Uh-huh.
Such a hopeful element. You know, the unconscious diction we were talking about in class yesterday when the students wrote impromptu little pieces.
Yes.
And I was able to cite the diction that came, the words they chose,
mm-hmm.
without consciously choosing them,
mm-hmm.
make up the tone of the poem.
That's right.
So I'm sure that you didn't realize that when all you did was set down what you saw.
Well, right, but at the same time, we were there on this first visit for 3 hours, and we knew that it would be rough. And when we were first there, my wife and I, we just felt like crying for the first 10 minutes. But then there's this commotion happening, and I thought there's so much to write about in this room right now. All these guys that are full of tattoos, and there's just all this energy and so many details to notice. I thought, well, what can I focus on? And so then I saw this painting on the wall, and we did stand in front of it for this photo, and I thought, well, that's the focus right there. And this painting, of course, is symbolic anyway. I don't think it was a surprise.
What was the painting?
Well, that of this covered bridge over a river.
Freedom.
The freedom. It's freedom.
And the diction, though, there is such hope in that poem, oddly enough, because your son has a white T-shirt. It's clean. It's white. He's there. It's going to be what it is.
Well, actually, it's my younger son.
That's the one.
Right, who's got that white T-shirt.
That's the one who was asleep in the car, and that's the one I'm talking about.
Right, and so there is his wellness there. And I guess I'm hoping that the one day my oldest son wears that white T-shirt, or that he falls asleep in the car while we do something else.
It's all there.
It's all there.
It is truly, the unconscious works well, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
William Palmer, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location with the poet and the poem, celebrating poetry. And I think that we're finding out a lot about it. When you read it right about prison life, low culture is the same as high culture in poetry, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It
is. Is there any difference for poetry?
When you get down to the heart of it, no.
Is there any traditional subject for poetry?
I don't
Can't
think
be,
so.
Can't be, really.
I mean, it's love and death and so on, but those ideas are in most poems.
I'm looking at your credentials here, and I wonder if there's something that I should say. I'm looking at pages and pages of published work, And, you know, this in itself is kind of the story of the writer's life, because each one of these things that I'm looking at that's been published is like 10 submissions to get it there. So if we multiply this, each one of these poems by 8 attempts to get published, mm-hmm. we know that it's nothing but a process.
That's right.
Ongoing process. Mm-hmm. And you are not afraid to partake of that.
No, it's necessary. I mean, it takes time to do, and as I work on this textbook, then I don't have that much time to really write poems, or as much time to send out poems. And so maybe a year or two will go by when I don't really publish any poems, although I've been writing poems.
You know, the good thing about the bird watcher being the bird, mm-hmm. the scholar as well as the poet, is that you have kept a chronicle.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, Bill, that's where I failed in my life. I really wish I had a list of every poet I had on the radio.
Mm.
You know, I wish I knew everything I had published. I wish I just, the cataloger, just after having 4 children and all, and a job and the radio, I just could not manage to list everything.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at yours, I kind of knew that I had to let something go. And I hope that you will continue listing every single little indentation you make in the universe, because it will work for you later. I have to make up a lot of stuff when they say, where was this published?
Yeah. Well, you've done so much, and you've interviewed over 2,000 poets. It would be hard to keep track of all of that on paper, even.
Well, it's all out there. You know, radio waves never stop. They go on forever into infinity.
Mm-hmm.
See, I didn't want any of the cheap stuff. Okay, this is Bill Palmer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're here about poetry, so poetry it is.
I'm interested in the idea that deep down in each of us, we have a wholeness. We have a hidden wholeness. That's an idea from Thomas Merton. William Stafford, the poet, talked about each of us has a coherence of the self. Maybe we don't see it often or feel it often, and it takes faith to believe it. But I've been feeling that it's there. And so this poem is called A Hidden Wholeness, with thanks to Thomas Merton. There is a hidden wholeness. Inside you can find a spark. Pick up one piece to restore the rest. Suppose you lost your son to a wilderness. His soul grows layers of bark. There is a hidden wholeness if your faith grows tenderness. At the bottom lies a choice for art. Pick up one piece to restore the rest. Suppose he is homeless. You used to sing him songs in the dark. There is a hidden wholeness that gathers luminescence from all the years of broken starts. Pick up one piece to restore the rest. Nothing matters more than this. One heart can heal another heart. There is a hidden wholeness. Pick up one piece to restore the rest.
Is that in form?
Right. That's in the form of a villanelle.
Is it villanelle?
Right.
And because I think that it's so seamless that we don't realize that you are really conforming, because it just flows. And the repetition of the line just led me to ask that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised how certain topics like forgiveness or wholeness find their way into these forms using repetition. It just seems to happen with me sometimes.
And so the poem asks to be what it wants.
I think so.
Yeah. And you don't fight with it.
No. In fact, I enjoy the challenge of trying to write in that form.
Mm-hmm. One thing that occurred to me as I was listening to that poem, and really all of them, is how poetry collapses the past and the present and makes it immediate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe a principle of physics. Maybe it's all the same thing, the now, the continuing present moment. And poetry, more than any other literature, I think, does that by shifting perspectives and creating a hologram,
mm-hmm.
In a magical way. You We are really transported with you into the prison waiting room. And yet we're right here listening to it. And yet it is going to be broadcast in a month. Mm. You know, and all of it is all at the same moment, really.
Mm-hmm.
So tiny miracles are nice to start the day with.
Yes.
Like poetry.
Yes.
Bill Palmer is our guest. It is the poet and the poem. He's the author of Discovering Arguments, which I think is a very interesting title on a metaphoric level, mm-hmm. because every poem is an argument.
Mm.
It is. It's a sort of an argument with self or with God or with something invisible.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I try not to think of poems as arguments, but I see what you're saying. I think of poems as invitations to explore. Maybe grace.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean that they can't be arguments as well.
I think we think of argument as confrontation, but
that's
when you
right.
think that something that intrudes on us, such as a thought or an emotion, and then we illuminate that.
Yeah.
That's a conflictual moment,
mm-hmm.
but it's maybe argument is a semantic problem, a term that we don't need to use. But I was just reading J.B., I told you that, Archibald MacLeish's mm-hmm. wonderful Pulitzer Prize winning play about mm-hmm. the God and Job arguing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really J.B.'s salvation mm-hmm. that was about the play.
Yeah.
And yet the argument was about salvation. So
yeah.
I guess we can finesse that.
Well, but it's true, though, that I can see in these poems of mine that there is this tension, that there is this kind of argument or this, there are these opposing forces that are kind of working with each other, trying to reconcile each other.
Oh, this is absolutely a good way to put it. Have you ever thought of it that way?
No.
Wow. I'm glad we're going to have this on tape. Because I don't know if you could have said that twice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I'm listening.
This is a poem called Yesvember. The young maple still holds a shrine of yellow leaves. Late afternoon light leans across our neighborhood. We can gather gratitude like firewood. We can see so many stars through bare trees.
Another.
This is... Kindness Knows for Michael Glaser. Kindness sits on the porch and watches hay yellowing on the field, fresh green rising through it, white lilacs by the gravel drive, the long gray sky. Kindness closes its eyes and smells the world. Each breath whispers thanks. Kindness isn't afraid to hold anyone despite hidden thorns, because kindness knows. Each breath is a clear petal. There are mountains of petals everywhere, if you believe. Thorns fall away from all the sweet pressure.
I'm making you open your satchel there and pull out some more for us. You know, your poems are literally almost each one the same length. How do you explain that? If ever there is an utterance that has a stream of breath, yours are very, very uniform, and that is partly because you're a seasoned writer. But you don't go, like, you're not all over the place.
Well, I do have some long poems. I have that poem about Tears in Light, about after seeing Mickey Rooney at a casino. That's a two-page poem.
Oh.
But
mm-hmm.
but I don't know.
I don't think anyone else has ever written a poem to Mickey Rooney.
No, I know it. I have some haikus as well, to which I'm interested in, you know.
Why?
Well, because I'm very intrigued by trying to find focused moments for all of my poems. Well, a haiku is a mini focused moment. And so if I can put words into that kind of a moment, then it gives me pleasure. And I just love that form.
You like miniatures.
At times I do.
My husband walked into your office yesterday, and he picked up this tiny little, he said, look at this little balsa wood square, having been an old model airplane builder. He said, what do you think this is about? And I said, I think I know. Bill told me. He said, why don't you tell everyone?
Well, it's a one-inch picture frame. And it's an idea I learned from Anne Lamott in her book Bird by Bird. And she advises writers to kind of go really small, and to every time they begin writing, if they're afraid that it just seems like too much work, then she advises them, just think of a 1-inch picture frame, something really small. Start with a paragraph or maybe a stanza of a poem. And if you can go there, then the rest will come.
So you literally built a teeny picture frame.
Well, right, because I wanted to show my students that, because I find that if I just talk about it without bringing some visual, then the words become too abstract. But if I bring a visual, then students will remember it more.
You are the professor who brought a raspberry on each finger last week. Well, and everyone ate raspberries.
Right. On the first day of class, I brought this, it was a blue plate of big raspberries, and I asked everyone to take one. And so we examined the raspberries, right, because it was after I gave students that ticket to notice things. And then it was just, it's fun at times just to pay attention to the physical world, because I want students to do that. And my hope is that after a while, they'll start paying attention to their inner world, and that they'll see connections between the two.
I felt so smart when Ken said to me, how did he make this? And I knew, because you told me you took 4 matches and knocked off the heads and pasted it. I felt so smart. So that was something I will want to do sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Focus. Find, you said they were talking about mom. Pretty big subject.
Well, right. How can you write a poem about mom? I mean, there's just so much to say. So what you have to do is try to apply that 1-inch frame and look for tiny moments of mom. Maybe tiny stories that involve mom. Maybe stories that contain friction or awe, or maybe both. Because that's what I'm finding. Many of my poems and many of the poems I read, they concern friction. Emotional friction, or they concern awe. There's something just awesomely beautiful, or they somehow combine both. Maybe the strongest poems combine both.
I'd like to hear another poem. This is Bill Palmer's voice you're going to hear. You know, you don't even have to choose, as far as I'm concerned. Just throw one up in the air. Whatever lands, we'll love.
Okay. This is a Celtic Knot. On their last day in Halifax, in a store with purple glass windows and a silver tin ceiling, a young woman shows them a gold ring with small circles crossed by cords of what comes before and what comes after. They order 2 to renew their vow and leave arm in arm, walking up a green hill to the old fort that looks out over the harbor of years to come. Then down to the docks they stroll, where boats unload lobsters, hard tails, full of sweet meat.
Harbor of years to come.
Yeah. This is a poem called Woman in the Tray. I used to take students to our human anatomy lab. The woman in the tray. Students huddle and smell the vinegar of her remains. The professor holds half of her brain and rubs a finger across convolutions. He lifts her breasts off her chest and lays them on her sides. He takes her heart and opens it like a music box. Students listen. He tells them to look around. Between her legs, dark gray, a storm with a mound of pale grass. But students can see light through her, where her husband entered this kingdom of joy, where her daughter's head once crowned.
Was that a controversial experience, taking students to the lab?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
One can see why.
Mm-hmm. But to my colleague who runs the lab felt that students in English and art ought to be able to see dead bodies as well as science students, and that this anatomy lab is really for everyone.
We're talking to Bill Palmer. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem, today from Alma College, Central Michigan.
This is a drop-off poem to my father. Yesterday was your birthday. I didn't think about you once. 65, you'd be casting at the edge of a drop-off, reeling in, pulling the line to tease what was there. 10 years, you've been in the drop-off. I don't know how deep it is. I don't know why the hook between us still changes. Some days the hook is lost in a gray tin can with 100 other hooks, like yesterday. Some days I find a nightcrawler dried to the hook. I try to peel it off, but it bleeds. Today, Father, I clean and file the hook until it shines and stings. A cardinal. After the long trip, he woke early and pulled the curtain open. In the distance, he saw a cardinal on a phone line, facing him, glowing red in focused light. He took it as a sign, and more than he deserved.
The voice of William Palmer. This is The Poet and the Poem. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. This Witterbinner series is made possible by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art, and the Witterbinner Foundation for Poetry. Our associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. Our engineer is Cameron Ray. I'm Grace Cavalieri.